Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 18, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Fisher v. University of Texas, the recent Fifth Circuit affirmative action case heard on remand from the U.S. Supreme Court. My name is David Ray, and I'm the Associate Practice Groups Director at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Andrew Grossman, of both Baker & Hostetler and of the Cato Institute. A more complete bio of Mr. Grossman was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Mr. Grossman, the floor is yours.
Thanks, David. The subject of our call today is Fisher versus University of Texas, which is a challenge to the University of Texas's affirmative action program. In June of 2013, the United States Supreme Court vacated a previous decision of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit upholding that program. The Supreme Court held that the Fifth Circuit, in its decision, had given undue deference to the university's position that racial classifications, in other words, affirmative action, were necessary to achieve its legitimate diversity goals. In this call, we'll discuss what's happened since that decision, where the case stands now, and what's happening next, both for the Fisher case itself, as well as for university affirmative action programs more generally. So we'll begin with just a little bit of background on the Fisher case. Fisher is Abigail Fisher, who applied to the University of Texas in 2008 and was not accepted to the school. The school at that time ran two separate and parallel admissions programs. One, mandated by statute, is Texas's top 10% program. The top 10% program awards an admission to a state university to any graduate any high school graduate who graduates in the top 10% of his or her class in Texas. At University of Texas Austin, the school at issue, this constitutes upwards of 80% of admissions of Texans. The remainder of students admitted to the University of Texas at Austin are admitted through the AI/PAI program, which is a holistic admissions program. AI stands for the Academic Index, which is a statistical index comprised of test scores, class rank, and other numerical measures of that sort. Personal Achievement Index is really what constitutes the holistic aspect of the admissions process. It takes into account the applicant's essays, their leadership activities, any skills and special abilities they may have, any adversities they may have overcome. And beginning in 2004, the university added to that PAI, the Personal Achievement Index, consideration of race as a so-called plus factor. The way admissions work in this program, which again accounts for less than 20% of Texans who are admitted to University of Texas at Austin, is the AI and the PAI, those two indices, are graphed on a grid, and the school effectively walks down the grid admitting students based on their point scores, going from one box to the next. So race effectively can be used to bump somebody ahead to an additional box that they would not have been in otherwise, and in that way can allow them to become admitted ahead of other people who don't receive that plus score. As the school puts it, it is a factor of a factor in the admissions process. The school claimed that its consideration of race was justified by the need to obtain a critical mass of minority students to obtain the benefits of classroom diversity. It based this rationale on the Supreme Court's 2003 decision in Grutter. In that case, the court held that a court may give some deference to university's judgment that racial diversity is essential to its educational mission. It held that strict scrutiny was still required to evaluate the need for consideration of race, but at the same time, it suggested that the narrow tailoring inquiry, in other words, the degree to which the university's actual program fits its expressed need, potentially would be given some amount of deference. It would not be potentially as strict as it is in other circumstances, for example, in the employment discrimination context. And in the Grutter case, it actually upheld, the Supreme Court not only held that diversity was a compelling governmental interest that might justify the use of race, it in fact upheld a affirmative action program at the University of Michigan School of Law. That program was implemented by the school to increase its percentage of minority, I think that black and Hispanic students, from 4% of all enrolled students up to 14%. So in that instance, to obtain, you know, the court held that a critical mass of students was probably unobtainable by another way, and that the school had in fact been able to demonstrate that. The University of Texas's program is a little bit different. In 2004, the last year before it began, before it again began considering the use of race in admissions, and when it was simply operating primarily under the top 10 program and then under this holistic program without considering the use of race, University of Texas, Texas student body was comprised of 21.5% Hispanic and African American students. Not only is that, of course, far more than the critical mass of students that was recognized at the University of Michigan School of Law, it's actually far more on a percentage basis than most of its peers. And the result, of course, was this case. Fisher versus University of Texas. In a very general sense, the plaintiff's argument in this case is that with so many minority students present on campus due to simple operation of the top 10 program, that the school already had a critical mass of students, and that therefore it didn't have any type of compelling interest in considering race, and that even if it did need to consider race, whatever program that it would come up with, including the one that it in fact did come up with, would necessarily not be narrowly tailored to any legitimate interest that it might have due to the large mass of minority students already present on campus through non-discriminatory means. The Fifth Circuit effectively, in its initial decision in the case, upheld the University of Texas Affirmative Action Program. According to the Fifth Circuit, there was a need for classroom diversity, or I guess it credited the University of Texas's claim that there was a need for greater classroom diversity and greater interactions, and that the social and educational experience at the school could be enriched. But the court not only deferred in terms of the university's identification of its of the educational benefits of having a diverse student body, it also deferred deferred to the university in its view that the particular way that Texas had gone about it was commensurate and had a very close fit with the compelling interest that Texas had that Texas had identified. That was the decision, of course, that the Supreme Court reversed in 2013. The Supreme Court, in a decision, Justice Kennedy, in a decision that was joined by seven of his colleagues, faulted the Fifth Circuit for being unduly deferential to the university's own opinion as to whether or not it had satisfied the requirements of strict scrutiny. While the court did acknowledge that, some deference was appropriate to the school, was appropriate on, as to whether or not. As to whether or not a school has a compelling interest in attaining certain types of racial and ethnic diversity so as to further its educational mission, it held also that strict scrutiny applies in the circumstance to narrow tailoring and that any in the same way that it applies in any other area of the law, including most particularly the employment discrimination context and other areas of government discrimination that are not considered to be benign, but merely discriminatory. For example, in the government, and that includes, among others, in the government contracting area. Comparing the Fifth Circuit's approach to those cases, particularly Adirond, among others, the court concluded quite easily that the Fifth Circuit had simply deferred too far. It had taken the university at its word that it had gone about its process in good faith. It had looked more to the university's procedures, in other words, the procedures by which it arrived at the particular program that it had, rather than the substance of that program itself. The result was not to have the seriously searching judicial review that's necessary when government discriminates amongst its citizens on impermissible and suspicious factors like race. The court remanded the case back to the Fifth Circuit to conduct the proper inquiry. And that's what the court did, the Fifth Circuit, that is, on July 15th of this year. The majority opinion once again upheld University of Texas's consideration of race in admissions. As an initial matter, it faulted the top 10% program as somehow itself being discriminatory, taking the view that the only reason there is a modicum of racial diversity at University of Texas is because Texas's high schools are so segregated, and because those high schools are segregated, the result is that the top 10%, if you take the top 10% of each school, you wind up with a wide racial array of students. The solution to this, according to the court, was that the university almost had to engage in some type of holistic review. But if it did that and it based its review primarily on things like academic achievement and you know, many measures of personal achievement, it would wind up with almost entirely white and Asian students unless it engaged in some type of preference regime. But it went further than that. That was enough for the court, I think, and the opinion is not exactly as clear as it could be on this point. But the court went further and said the University of Texas was in this circumstance, but it identified a particular type of student that was missing from the mix of its admittees in the absence of consideration of race, and this was not a quantitative measure of students. In other words, it wasn't that there weren't enough black students or there weren't enough Hispanic students, it was qualitative. And what the school was looking for, according to the court, was diversity within diversity. And this was based on the assumption that many top 10 admittees are going to be from majority-minority districts. In other words, you may have Hispanic students from largely majority Hispanic districts, or you may have black students from largely African-American majority districts. And according to the court, and I quote, "The experience of being a minority," and this is by contrast, "the experience of being a minority in a majority white or majority minority school and succeeding in that environment offers a rich pool of potential UT Austin students with demonstrated qualities of leadership and sense of self." In other words, the court took the view that there was some type of quality that a minority student who attended a majority white school would somehow be able to bring to the University of Texas that other types of students who were admitted through the top 10 program and came from majority minority districts would not be able to bring. These types of people, according to the school, and the majority echoed this, can be, quote, change agents who are able to combat pernicious stereotypes. You know, in discussion about the case, sort of the archetype of this type of student is a black or Hispanic son or daughter of an orthodontist, perhaps, who lives in a majority white school district and attends the public schools in that area. And the idea, I suppose, if one's to credit it, is that these people, merely by their presence on campus, and by their interaction in classroom affairs, will somehow act to change stereotypes and give people a different view of what it is that minority students are capable of or what they may think or what experiences they may have and so on. To be clear, none of these ideas are particularly well developed in University of Texas' briefing in the case, and they actually find greater elucidation in the majority opinion than anything that the University of Texas has ever said. The majority also noted that in a certain sense, at least the University of Texas' holistic program, that is the small program that admits fewer than 20% of students, does look a little bit like University of Michigan Law School's in Grutter, the one that was upheld by the Supreme Court. As the court noted, both programs consider race as a factor of a factor. In Texas, as explained, it is only part of a personal achievement index, which is only part of the holistic admissions process. And finally, the court concluded that in obtaining this qualitative measure of diversity, that this was an essential interest of the school. The court said that it was simply persuaded of this. It took the university at its word that this was necessary for it to carry out its educational mission. Judge Garza dissented from the majority opinion, and he identified a number of problems with both Texas' approach as well as the reasoning of the majority. But the real fundamental one, as he identified it, is that the university never really even attempts to define critical mass, which is the avowed basis for its affirmative action program. In that circumstance, it's simply impossible to carry out any kind of narrow tailoring analysis. After all, how can you measure fit when you don't know what it is that you're fitting to? As he explained, the government's burden is to show that the use of racial classifications is necessary, and that its particular use, in other words, each aspect of it, is tailored to the interest that it has identified. In other words, racial classifications in every instance must be a last resort, and that means that you have to know what the goal is that a university is attempting to achieve so that you can determine whether or not it's using racial classifications truly as a last resort, or whether there is some lesser means that may enable it to achieve that goal. So what is University of Texas's goal? Well, being particularly vicious, Judge Garza does something that's a bit puckish. He quotes the university. According to the university, its, quote, concept of critical mass is defined by reference to the educational benefits that diversity is designed to produce. Okay, well, what does that mean? How do you address when it is likely, when a certain type of diversity is likely to achieve a critical mass? According to the university, a university achieves a critical mass when it determines that the educational benefits of diversity can be achieved through a race-neutral policy. In other words, its view of critical mass is entirely cynical. We know that we have critical mass when we have educational benefits of diversity. Well, how do we know when we have educational benefits of diversity? Well, when it's apparent that we have attained a critical mass. This raises more than a few problems. First of all, there's the problem that the Supreme Court identified in its Parents Involved case. How on earth does admitting a very small number of minority applicants through this a tiny percentage of this 20% program help the university achieve? How is it essential to a university achieving a critical mass goal, something that is necessary and compelling? By the university's own numbers, we're talking at most about a few dozen students out of a class of over 6,000 new students per year. And the university doesn't even present any evidence that it's necessarily just that number of students. It may be fewer, it may be more. In these circumstances, how is it possible to say that the consideration of race, and indeed, how is it necessary that identifying thousands of applicants by race and sorting them in that fashion, giving some of them plus factors and some of them not, how is it possible to say that that is truly necessary to carrying out any particular end when, indeed, it's such a small percentage of the university's overall admission? A second problem is that the university now claims, as explained, that its interest is not quantitative but qualitative. This is the so-called diversity within diversity jurisdiction, the orthodontist child. But it's never been shown that the type of qualitative diversity that the university seeks is absent in the race-neutral top 10 program. In fact, the university never even looked at that. It simply assumes that minority students from minority communities lack the type of qualities that it seeks. Moreover, its holistic program, that is the AIPI program, the holistic take everything into account program, actually puts a thumb on the scale against minority students from majority white communities, because they're more likely to come from high performing schools with better socioeconomic backgrounds, and the students themselves are less likely to have disadvantaged economic backgrounds. So in other words, the university's proffered justification for its use of race is actually completely at odds with the actual program that it's implemented as a matter of fact. A third problem is that to the extent that the University of Texas continues to rely on its classroom diversity rationale, which is something that it appears to have abandoned in its return trip to the Fifth Circuit, it's simply never shown that the use of race, that its use of race has done anything to channel minorities into competitive majors that lack minority students. The university complained that certain classrooms lacked diverse perspectives because they may have lacked certain majors and certain programs lacked students of particular racial and ethnic backgrounds. But the strange thing is that its consideration of race, its admission system, is actually set up to prevent the channeling of particular minority students into particular types of programs. Race is considered before the university admissions office sits down with representatives of the school's different programs to work out who gets into which program. Nobody knows at that stage what race each student who's admitted is. It's simply not part of the consideration. So if that's the university's justification, well, it's clearly one that's adopted post hoc. It has nothing to do with the program that the university has put in place. A fourth problem is that there's simply no logical end to the University of Texas's consideration of race. According to the university, it will, quote, cease its consideration of race when it determines that the educational benefits of diversity can be achieved through a race-neutral policy at reasonable cost to its other educational objectives. Judge Garza puts it as follows. The university asserts that it knows critical mass when it sees it. I think that's a fair characterization. At base, Judge Garza concludes that the university simply fails to show the consideration of that its consideration of race is necessary, and because it's failed to consider whether the top 10 law, combined with a race-neutral holistic program, is an adequate alternative to reach the goals that it's identified. Drawing largely on Judge Garza's dissent, the plaintiff filed a petition for rehearing en banc, that is, a petition for rehearing by the full court, on July 29th of this year. The primary argument was that what the majority had applied was simply not strict scrutiny. Instead, the panel allowed University of Texas to propose a new rationale on appeal, one that is simply made up for purposes of litigation. The majority conducted its own fact-finding to support that rationale, going far outside the record. And then it deferred to university's assertion that pursuit of race in this way was necessary and narrowly tailored, in the absence of any evidence supporting that. But nothing in the record shows the qualitative diversity is absent among the minority students admitted under the race-neutral top 10 program, or that any minority students admitted under holistic review do in fact come from majority white schools. Well, that was about a month and a half from now, which is typically far longer than petitions for rehearing en banc are pending. At this point, although it's hard to tell, and it certainly could go the other way, there's at least some likelihood that the court is denied internally, that it's voted to deny the en banc petition, and that one or more judges at this point are acting to write dissents from denial of rehearing en banc, and perhaps concurrences to denial of rehearing as well. Denial of rehearing en banc, of course, is what happened last time when the Fisher case came before the Fifth Circuit. A shift of two votes would have made a difference in that case. And one of those votes, interestingly enough, was Judge Garza, who at the time believed that although he, as a constitutional matter, may not have appreciated the majority's reasoning in the prior hearing of the case, that he did express his hope that the Supreme Court would view things differently, as it subsequently did in its Fisher decision. So the question now is, assuming that the Fifth Circuit does not rehear the case, that the full Fifth Circuit does not rehear the case, what are the prospects going forward? Is the Supreme Court likely to take the case? Well, it's certainly unclear. The chief benefit of hearing Fisher would be that it would give the court an opportunity to clarify the application of strict scrutiny in this area. The court could finally identify exactly what it meant by critical mass in Grutter and could provide some guidance to both universities and to lower courts as to how this type of inquiry needs to be carried out, what factors are relevant, and really to what extent should a court credit the assertions and the arguments of a university rather than reaching its own conclusions based on the facts and the record. But there are also, and that would be, I should note, a very useful service, because at this point there hasn't been a great deal of case law explicating the Grutter standard, and there is a lot of uncertainty as to how it applies. And universities have taken particular advantage of that to implement and expand racial classification programs that may not be consistent with the spirit of Grutter and are certainly not consistent with the spirit of Fisher. That's why in the wake of Fisher, so many university presidents and university administrators took the opportunity to express their opinion that the opinion changed nothing. Because if it did represent a change, it may well invalidate a number of programs that are currently in place. But there is also a case against the court considering Fisher. To a large extent, any further consideration of the case by the Supreme Court would simply amount to error correction. The Fifth Circuit got it wrong. Yeah, they deferred a little bit too much, but it did identify the proper standard, that is strict scrutiny, and any errors that it made were simply errors in this particular case that don't necessarily implicate any larger and broader legal principles. In addition, the situation of the University of Texas is somewhat fact-bound. Texas itself has a very unique racial makeup, and the top 10% law is also somewhat unique. A decision in a case like Fisher may not have much of an impact anywhere outside of Texas. And when you think about it, what exactly could Fisher do in terms of advancing the law that it hasn't done already? Its chief contribution was to make clear that strict scrutiny is strict scrutiny is strict scrutiny, even if you're talking about university affirmative action programs. It's difficult to tell what broad rules, what general guidance the court could come up with that would really add on to that. In addition, there are more cases coming down the pike that actually challenge Grutter's diversity rationale directly. One interesting point of Fisher is that it actually doesn't seek to overturn Grutter. It sought to upend the University of Texas's program by relying on Grutter and by taking seriously the narrow tailoring analysis that applies under that decision. But the Project for Fair Representation, which has provided representation to Abigail Fisher in this case, has announced that it intends in coming months to bring cases challenging affirmative action plans at Harvard, University of North Carolina, and University of Wisconsin. And those cases are going to raise the broader challenge as to whether or not diversity interests ever justify the use of racial classifications. And those cases will probably also challenge the narrow tailoring of those schools' affirmative action programs as well. Because some of those schools may be a little bit more representative in terms of their locations and the surrounding populaces, as well as how it is they admit students, there may be a greater possibility for those cases to be a better and more viable vehicle to raise these types of questions than the Fisher case. But let's say the court does take it. What's the lineup? What happens? Well, there's certainly a possibility that the Chief Justice could pull off yet another supermajority. If there is a sufficiently narrow opinion that strikes down University of Texas's consideration of race on narrow tailoring grounds. The facts here are particularly egregious. The university's proper justifications simply don't match what its actual program does, and that's something that the Supreme Court could work with very easily. The downside, as explained, is that it simply wouldn't create much of a rule for courts to apply in subsequent cases. One, of course, can assume that Justice Ginsburg and probably Justice Sotomayor would probably dissent even from something like that. But it may well be the case that Justices Breyer and Kagan would be willing to go along with a sufficiently narrow decision. If the court does adopt a broader decision, there's probably no indication at this point that it intends to reverse Grutter, that is, to reverse the holding that diversity does present a compelling governmental interest that in some circumstances may justify the consideration of race. But at the very least, there is the possibility that something like Justice Kennedy's dissent in Grutter could become law. In other words, something that requires that harkens back a little bit more directly to the Supreme Court's original consideration of this issue in the Bakke case in the 70s. That said, that would be at best an incremental benefit. At this point, the Supreme Court seems to have largely achieved that goal in its Fisher case. But given the way the Fifth Circuit treated its remand order, it may well be worth it for the court simply to say we really meant it, and to make clear that what it said in Fisher is indeed the law and that strict scrutiny does apply in this area. On balance, there's probably a substantial likelihood that the Supreme Court will take the case despite the error correction nature of the appeal. It can still do a little bit in this area, and it can still make clear at least its attitude, if not anything new, with respect to the law. So, with all that said, I'd be happy to take any questions you may have about this case or about the issue in general.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I will now open the floor to our audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We will be answering questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. We'll now go to the first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. What we have in this case is a conflict between a certain kind of discrimination that is thought to be valid, perhaps based upon some definition of merit, and discrimination that's not valid. And we are uncertain, based upon the arguments that have been made in this case, as to where the basis for validity of any discrimination might lie. And it also suggests that perhaps the college admissions process is the wrong point at which to apply any such tests, and that we need to move back to an earlier stage of childhood development and just leave college admissions to perhaps be a random selection among those that meet a minimum standard. What do you think about that?
Well, you raise a couple of interesting issues. I mean, first of all, you know, the court has for the past 30 years made clear the position that so-called benign discrimination, you know, what in other contexts may be called affirmative action, things that might be programs that might be put into place to remedy historical discrimination or to further diversity goals, are despite the fact that they're benign, are nonetheless subject to the same strict scrutiny requirements as racial discrimination that might be viewed as invidious. As the courts explained, race and ethnicity so seldom present a valid basis of discrimination for the government, and so often can be misused, that simply an assertion that a particular use of race may or may not be benign is insufficient to even alter the standard. In each instance, the government has to prove that it has a compelling interest and that that what it's done is, in every respect, narrowly tailored to further that interest. You know, your question, you know, with respect to, you know, I'm going to take it as a question of, you know, courts policing university admissions, because I think that, you know, it does raise certain questions and certain difficulties. You know, and you can look at it really, I think, from either way. One is that, you know, in many cases, these are going to be state universities, so you actually have straightforward governmental action that, in some sense, is relying on race, that is relying on racial classifications. And of course, that's something that requires, you know, great, you know, judicial attention, you know, when there are accusations that the government may be discriminating in an invalid or improper manner. On the other hand, I mean, it does raise something a little bit unusual for courts to attempt to oversee, you know, educational institutions that do have their own missions, you know, and that are involved in many decisions that are of a distinctly non-judicial nature. At the same time, it's proven very difficult as a practical matter for courts to oversee and to superintend university admission programs, particularly those involving race. I mean, look at the case right here, Fisher. You know, by all appearances, the university has made its admissions program so complicated and been so fuzzy-headed about the whole thing that the majority in Fisher, if you want to give them the benefit of the doubt, basically threw its hands up in the air and said, well, you know, it looks like they're going about it here in good faith. It looks like they've at least tried to sort of comply with the law, and it doesn't look like they're doing this for any particularly bad purpose. And therefore, what else can a court really do? What other standard would we necessarily apply? Who are we to tell them that their diversity interests that they've identified as being essential to their educational mission are in fact not? And if we are going to tell them that, or if we're going to tell them that the way they're going about it isn't the right way to do it, what do we replace that with? What kind of guidance do we give them? These are all incredibly difficult questions for courts. Now, one way to deal with this, of course, would be a categorical rule, one that simply does not allow consideration of race except for in circumstances where it can satisfy, at the least, strict scrutiny. Another possibility is suggested by Justice Thomas, as well as by Justice Scalia, is simply that the use of race is effectively categorically prohibited, except in areas where, you know, imminent national security threats are in place, which would be a very rare circumstance indeed. But, you know, it does put courts in very difficult places, and it puts universities in difficult places, too, when they have to interact in this fashion with the judicial process. I think this is part of why we've seen so few cases challenging these programs, even though they affect so many different people. It's very difficult litigation to bring. It's incredibly fact-intensive, and it's very expensive. These are not easy cases to judge, and so I guess that would lead one to wonder, is this the kind of thing that courts ought to be judging? And certainly a categorical rule of some kind would deal with that.
Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. And I believe we have another question.
Hi, my name is Andrew Block from George Mason University School of Law. I'm wondering. Hello.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I'm just wondering, I guess, you were talking about how they, if they were going to take it, and they just took Schutte last year, obviously. And Sotomayor had a very impassioned dissent. And I'm guessing, I'm wondering how eager are they to take another case like that? And if so, to what extent does that case control?
To what extent does Schutte control?
No. To what extent does that case control the upcoming one? Does the holding, they rejected the, or they upheld the state amendment. So to what extent does that decision control,
right,
control the case we're talking about?
Well, let me address that first. You know, Schutte really concerns, you know, an application of the, what's called the political structuring doctrine. And so it didn't really go to the merits at all of universities' consideration of race. So I think Schutte, you know, except for some sort of general atmospherics, probably is not all that relevant to any future university affirmative action case that the court may take. You know, as to whether or not the court is likely to take it, I think the answer is yes. You know, there's certainly a case to be made against it, but there are some benefits, right? The court's already familiar with it. It's already familiar with the, you know, with the legal issues that are presented. And the Fifth Circuit disrespected its remand order. The Supreme Court ordered the Fifth Circuit to apply standard strict scrutiny and to engage in a rigorous narrow tailoring analysis. And the Fifth Circuit did anything but that. You know, unless that panel decision is vacated by en banc consideration, it seems to me that the Supreme Court should take the case to make clear that it said what it, or it meant what it said, and that it's not going to tolerate lower courts deviating, you know, in a general sense from its remand orders, and in a more specific sense, from engaging in these sorts of half-hearted, narrow-tailoring inquiries when you're considering some of the most potentially serious abuses of government power that there may possibly be, discrimination against citizens on the basis of their race. I don't think that's something that at least a majority of the court would countenance.
Okay. Once again, to ask a question, please push the star button and the pound button. And we have another question.
Yes, I'm Stephen Casey from Austin, Texas. It seems to me, just with respect to the topic in general, that the University of Texas and the courts that are saying it's okay to make this division based on race, which is somehow relevant to diversity in the classroom, that they're stuck in a 1964 Civil Rights Act paradigm, whereas right now, the biggest consideration, as I see in Texas, as applied to the facts and nationally in general, is economic consideration. And while that might have a correlation with minority interests in some areas, it doesn't in others. And so it seemed to me that the arguments, particularly with an African-American president, need to be modernized. And when they say diversity in the classroom, they used to use that in an affirmative action sense, meaning these people came from an economically depressed situation and didn't have all the opportunities. But I think that's gone by the wayside now. You know, in 2014, and then when this case arose, to say that's not the issue. Because, I mean, I look at my own situation. I'm a Caucasian, only person in my family to go 4 years of college, only one to go to law school. And it's becoming now a different model when we're in the 2000s than we were in 1964, and the university is still stuck in that paradigm. Could you comment on that?
Sure. First of all, you're absolutely right that affirmative action, when it was initially used, when the term was initially used, actually didn't refer to racial preferences at all. It referred generally to just, in many cases, to outreach programs to minority students, to programs to make them feel more hospitable, and just a wide array of race-neutral alternatives that were meant to encourage, you know, greater diversity, you know, on campuses and in businesses and in government, but at the same time, didn't provide any type of explicit plus factor or something like that. Of course, over time, actually quite quickly, that those aspects of affirmative action fell by the wayside, and we're where we are now, where the term generally just refers to racial preferences. As to socioeconomic diversity, it's certainly a topic that comes up a lot, and it's one that was brought up in the context of this particular case, where people have made the argument that the University of Texas would probably do better to consider socioeconomic diversity rather than something as ham-handed as racial diversity, because that would supply a potentially greater range of experiences. The example again that's often used for the type of qualitative diversity that the University of Texas claims that it's seeking is a Black or Hispanic orthodontist child who lives perhaps in a majority white community and goes to a majority white school. And people, I think, have legitimately raised the question, to what extent would that type of student necessarily, in other words, if you knew nothing else about them, if you were trying to decide whether to give them a plus factor for that or not, to what extent would that type of student necessarily add more diversity than somebody who's come from a more impoverished community, from somebody whose family has not attended four-year colleges in the past, from somebody whose family, whose parents may not have graduated from high school even? And it's a fair question, although I would note that it's one that in this instance the university rejected out of hand. The university explained that it simply wasn't, that was not the type of diversity that it was looking for. And it argued that in any case, the majority of the poor in Texas are actually white. And so in that instance, in their view, they still would not be able to get the right type of mix that they are looking for. And when you think about it, that type of response and that type of analysis really does bring to the fore the sort of farce that's at the center of this case, right? Because the University of Texas has determined absolutely that it wishes to engage in racial preferences, that it wishes to take account of race in its admissions process. And it's come up with any number of justifications as to why it wants to do that, even though they don't fit the program that it has whatsoever. They are, in fact, in many cases, perfectly opposed to it. And at the same time, the university has come up with a wide variety of reasons why other things it would, that it could do to increase certain types of diversity on campus are simply unequal to its interests. The one thing we can conclude from all of this is that the University of Texas would really, really, really like to take account of race in part of its admissions process. It thinks that that's the right thing to do and that that's proper for the university. But to this day, the university has really struggled to put forward a coherent explanation of why it is that it needs to do this. And until it does that, it's difficult to argue with the university that it may be able to satisfy its goals by other means, because we don't know what its goals are. If one thinks the university is operating in bad faith, one might assume that it's acting simply in a discriminatory fashion. But assuming that the university does have some type of more concrete goal in this area, greater clarity with respect to what that is may allow there to be a more searching review of alternative means.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. And again, anyone wishing to ask a question needs to push the star button and the pound button on the telephone. But before we go on to the next question, I do want to make a quick announcement. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be on Monday, September 22nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We will host a discussion on author Paul Barrett's latest book, Law of the Jungle, the $19 billion legal battle over oil in the rainforest and the lawyer who'd stop at nothing to win. I invite you to consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls at the Teleforum page of the Federal Society's website and to visit our podcast page, which includes podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum conference calls. But I understand we have another question, so caller, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Do you hear me?
Yes.
We hear you fine.
Yeah, great. I always thought that the diversity rationale for compelling interest is quite laughable. I mean, kind of, you could make the argument 50 years ago that the University of Mississippi thought segregation was a compelling interest, as you put races in the same classroom, they won't get along, they'll be fighting. So it always struck me strange that there's a diversity is a compelling state interest, particularly when you have Howard University and also historically Black colleges. But the question I guess I have is, do you think since it's been in place since the Greer decision the last decade that people are just reluctant to even challenge the notion that diversity is a compelling state interest, and they're willing to sort of nibble on the edges, this kind of diversity is okay, this other kind of diversity is not that compelling. I don't know if you understand my question or not.
Sure. Well, as to your first point, regarding, that some of these diversity arguments look a lot like arguments that were mustered in support of segregation if you go back to the 50s and the 60s. I think in some instances that's probably right. And in some instances, even more specifically, I would commend to you Justice Thomas's concurrence in Fisher, which actually addresses that particular question at great length and really draws some very clear and troubling parallels between the arguments that are being mustered in support of diversity and affirmative action today and those that were mustered years ago in support of segregation, state-sanctioned and state-mandated segregation. Moving on to your question, why is it that that we don't see more challenges to these types of university programs? Well, I think I identified one reason earlier, which is simply that it's expensive and it's really difficult. You've got a young person who is applying to college and maybe doesn't get into where they want. Maybe you've got an organization that's launching a class action or something like that. But it's whichever you look at, it's going to be very expensive. The litigation is going to take forever. I mean, after all, in the Fisher case, we're still talking about the 2008 admission year. In this case, may go on for another year, year and a half, or longer. And certainly, people are worried about some amount of social opprobrium. I understand that in some cases, people who have been plaintiffs in these types of lawsuits, have faced some amount of harassment. And it's a difficult thing to ask a younger person to do at the very outset of their adulthood and their professional careers to be the named plaintiff in a case as something like this. But even getting away from that, the law is so fuzzy right now, and the way that universities have addressed these programs is so unclear, and it's so difficult to find out the facts of what's going on. Everything is just done behind closed doors, and it's very difficult in many instances to get good statistics, which is something that Rick Sanders, who wrote a book about this with Stuart Taylor last year, which is something that they identified, that really all the way these decisions are made, it's very difficult to evaluate them in the kind of way that you would need to do in many instances to bring a lawsuit. But there's another reason as well why we haven't seen any direct challenges to the notion of diversity as a compelling state interest, and that's look at the makeup of the court. Well, Grutter did accept diversity as such an interest. And while Justice Kennedy did dissent from that decision, Justice Kennedy, who is the swing vote in this, does believe that diversity in the right circumstances can be a compelling governmental interest that might justify the consideration of race in university admissions. His view, however, is that it needs to be done in a way that's much clearer and much more narrowly tailored and much more holistic, than was the case in Grutter and probably than was the case in is the case in University of Texas at this point. It may well be the case, as Justice Kennedy comes to see more of these programs and understands how they discriminate, particularly against Asian applicants, and how what might sound nice in theory can be potentially very difficult to carry out in practice, that there may not be an existing university program at this point that actually meets what is in his mind the type of program that would be permissible. And even if there were such a program, it may not be possible to ferret it out given the judicial process and given the difficulties of challenging these types of programs. So it's certainly possible that Justice Kennedy may change his view on this from what he expressed in Grutter, at least change it somewhat in terms of the remedy, the ultimate constitutional law rule. But at the same time, his Grutter decision is the best statement of his views on the area, and at this point, it doesn't look like there are 5 votes to overrule that aspect of Grutter.
I understand we have another question waiting. So, caller? You're on.
Hi, Professor. Really enjoying the program, although I just caught the last half of it. I hope you'll forgive a tangential question. And this has to do with, I have recently been looking for LLM programs. I'm an attorney in North Carolina. And the many of the LLM programs, perhaps the majority, allow only foreign students in. Not American students. And I guess my question is, isn't that a blatant illegal example of discrimination based on national origin? Thanks.
Sure. I mean, first of all, you know, it's kind of a humorous thing. I mean, you can certainly imagine why it is that schools want to do that. With law school enrollment plummeting, law schools would certainly love to engage in some amount of price discrimination, and they can do that by channeling domestic students into their three-year programs and then foreign students into their LLM programs, thereby exacting the maximum possible rent from each possible student. So it certainly makes sense from a financial point of view, so far as it may go. But in terms of discrimination, it's a really good question and one that I don't really know the answer to. You know, Justice Powell's controlling decision in Bakke does mention discrimination by national origin, but that's not really something that's come up a huge amount in the litigation, and certainly not before the Supreme Court in recent years. In some areas, of course, the government is entirely can in an entirely legitimate way make certain types of distinctions on the basis of national origin. Maybe not between different national origins. In other words, someone who comes from China versus somebody who comes from Japan. You know, in that instance, you know, that may be illegitimate. But certainly between someone who is a United States citizen or a permanent resident versus someone who is a resident and citizen of a foreign country. And so I assume it's really the latter type of distinction that's at issue in the case where you mean with respect to LLM programs. And, you know, it may be the case that, you know, the government does have a legitimate interest in doing that. And certainly government policies treat foreign persons different in any number of ways.
Well, it may in fact be legitimate, but that's rational review. Does the government have a compelling interest in discriminating against me on the basis of my American origin?
Well, as I said, it's not apparent to me that type of discrimination, in other words, between someone who is a U.S. citizen or permanent resident as against someone who is a foreign person, it's not apparent to me that that's even subject to strict scrutiny. I'm not even sure that that's subject to rational basis scrutiny. Presumably, it's subject to some degree of scrutiny, but, you know, in the couple of cases of which I'm aware of where that particular question has been raised, most recently, for example, in the Hedges case in the Second Circuit, the court ducked the question entirely because in these instances, the court normally finds you know, in many cases, like there's a lack of standing or something like that to even pursue the question.
Mm-hmm.
Because frequently you have what would seem to be the reverse situation where you have somebody who is a foreign person who potentially would like to take advantage of some type of U.S. domestic benefit. And usually you have a standing or a ripeness problem or something like that when those types of circumstances come up. But like I said, it's not apparent to me what degree of scrutiny, you know, I'm sure it's something one could look up, and I just don't know the answer off the top of my head.
Okay, well, thanks. I just basically remember my basic con law classes where alienage was up there with race in terms of getting strict scrutiny on equal protection grounds. But anyway, I appreciate your response, and thank you again.
Sure.
This will be a final call for questions. If anyone has a question, please push star and then pound on your telephone. It looks like we might have exhausted our questions today, Mr. Grossman. So, apparently there is one more person with a question. Caller, go ahead.
Hi, Andrew. This is Roger Clegg. I waited until the very end because I didn't want to take a chance away from anybody else to ask questions of you. Great presentation. I wanted to ask whether, you know, maybe the only way to get to where Justice Kennedy would like to get in this area would be for him to ban the use of racial and ethnic preferences, because if that happened, there would probably be still, you know, some amount of cheating, or at least some consideration of race and ethnicity where it's sort of indivisible from considering the person's you know, background and experiences, and of course that's what we've seen happening. The cheating part is what we've seen happening at UCLA apparently, and But that kind of limited consideration of race when it's, you know, inextricably part of someone's background is probably what Justice Powell had in mind in Bakke all along. So what are your thoughts on that?
Roger, I think first, thanks for the question. And second, it's a very persuasive point. You know, in a certain sense, the strict scrutiny, as it might apply to the use of race in university administrations, is not very judicially administrable due to the complexity of these programs and due, as you said, to the way that cheating is available and in some cases may well be pervasive. We really just don't know and we have no way of knowing. Applicants don't have any way of knowing. And so you have this one area where the government is doling out incredibly valuable benefits and may acknowledge that in some instances that is doing that on the basis of racial classifications, and yet there's very little in most instances that a court can do to supervise that and ensure that it's complying with the letter of the law. You also have the problem, you know, that's raised by the parents involved case, where, you know, in Justice Kennedy's view, you know, the proper consideration of race is, you know, the right amount, not too little, not too much. It has to be a well-balanced, holistic program. And, you know, in some theoretical world, there may be such a program that potentially could exist. But in the real world, you know, you wind up with programs like University of Texas's, which, you know, where you're dealing with a very, very small number of students, and, you know, and that's it. Or you wind up with a program like that in some of the more elite schools, where the consideration of race may be too large, where it really does look like the school is using something like a quota. Looking for the just right program, the one that fits, these very fine parameters that Justice Kennedy, the sense of justice that he carries within him, may not be something that's possible. And even if it is possible, it may not be something that a court could adequately enforce, forget the majority of cases, but even a few of them. So it may well be the case that although Justice Kennedy may continue his belief that some amount of affirmative action should be possible in university admissions under the Constitution, he may well come to recognize that as a practical matter, it's just not something that our current legal institutions can deal with. And that, you know, as a result, some type of prophylactic rules the court has applied in numerous other areas is necessary. I think that's something, though, probably not for this case, but for the next round of cases.
I think if the door is left ajar, then universities are going to drive a truck through it.
Okay, it does seem that at this point we have exhausted the questions today, Mr. Grossman, so perhaps you have successfully answered everything that was on our audience's mind. I'll give you a few moments to wrap up if you have any closing thoughts.
Only closing thought, you know, we can know, we may know as soon as this week or within the next couple of weeks what the Fifth Circuit is going to do with respect to the request for rehearing on Bonk and Fisher. And my expectation, although certainly not my knowledge, but my expectation is that if the Fifth Circuit does deny rehearing on Bonk, that the plaintiff in that case will probably seek Supreme Court review. So this case is certainly continuing, and, you know, it could continue to make law in this area.
Well, then, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Mr. Grossman today, and I also want to express our gratitude to our audience. We welcome your feedback by email, so you can send your comments to info@fed-soc.org. Please also join us for our next Teleforum on Monday, September 22nd at 1 p.m., and until then, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.